The Winter Park History Museum presents A Stroll Down Park Avenue, the podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Winter Park History Museum podcast. I am Paul Twyford, the president of the board, and I am joined by some esteemed individuals today. We are really excited about this particular podcast for a couple of reasons. Number one, we are on location today here at the beautiful Winter Park Country Club, which has a whole history unto itself, which we'll talk a little bit about today. And for the second reason is we're breaking with tradition a little bit in terms of the way that we're doing this podcast, because instead of just interviewing one individual for the duration of the podcast, we are joined by four people to help regale us with the history of golf in Winter Park. And that is the subject of our podcast today. So I am going to allow each of these four gentlemen to introduce themselves and talk a little bit about their connection to golf in Winter Park. Would you start us off, Randy?
Certainly. I'm Randy Knight. I'm the city manager for the city of Winter Park. And, you know, my connection to this course, obviously, is that it's run by our Parks and Rec department. And so from the time we bought it to today, and even before that, we leased the golf course. So the city's been running it my entire 30 years with the city. So that's my connection.
Okay. Bill?
I'm Bill Neidlinger. I'm probably the newest member of this foursome because I've lived in Winter Park 15 years. My wife and I left Atlanta, ran to Little Winter Park. This has been my home course for all the years that we've been here, and it's made some great memories and legacies. I was in the golf business in Atlanta, as was another one of our panel members here in a minute, Gary Deal.
Okay,
great.
Good to be here. And my name is Gary Brewer. I was mayor at the time that we purchased the property, as Randy had alluded to, that for 80 years this was leased by the city, or to the city, parts of it. Part of the golf course was actually donated by the Morris Foundation. The first two, the ninth and the first hole, were donated as a park. And then the remaining holes we purchased in 1995.
Well, my name is Gary Deal. I moved here 16 years ago, 1 year before Bill. I spent 40 years in the golf industry, managing a number of different companies like Ram Golf, and I was a vice president of Thailand's Golf. So I was involved with the golf industry for a long time. And I came here to work for a golf company that was located over in Pennsylvania Avenue, right across the street from the fourth hole, which was nice, a nice association. And so I sort of adopted this as my little golf course too, and then watch how it changed over those 16 years, and that brought us to the point where the task force was created by the former mayor, Ken Bradley, and I was glad I got to be part of it, and I became the chairman of that task force, and we'll get into that as we go through this podcast.
Okay. So as our viewers can already see, we've got we're really excited to have assembled this foursome, as you put it. I love that. To help kind of guide us through the history of golf in Winter Park. So let's kind of start at the beginning, shall we? So in 1900, the Winter Park Golf Club held its first annual meeting. Anybody would care to comment on that? Or,
well, I think it's interesting to note that this is actually the second golf course. The very first golf course was down by the Alabama Hotel and the property where City Hall is today, the Women's Club, and that whole area was the first nine-hole course. And then in late 1800s, early 1900s, maybe late 1800s, there was a fire, burned the hotel down, and it was rebuilt at the end of Webster Avenue, the second Alabama Hotel. So, of course, the golf course then was moved down here. And the foundation, Winter Park, the Morris Genius Foundation, the Morris Foundation actually owned all of this property. So,
and who were the individuals who were involved in some of those iterations?
In forming the club, I don't know that early history, but I believe probably all of the names that we know from the streets and right. Park, Comstock and Chapman and all of those people,
Morris.
Probably, and Morris, obviously, and they were golfers. And that was, I guess, as you indicated, the first meeting was held in
1900, according to the timeline I have in front of me. There's, you know, history is a funny thing where, you know, there's sometimes
dates.
Yeah, there you go.
I heard Gary was there, so I
don't know. It didn't take us long to go down that slippery slope, did it?
Well, the one name that was probably associated back in 1900 was Charles Hosmer Morse, who was involved with that, and then eventually in 1914 started this beautiful facility. So he seems to be the integral part of really all the development. And it's amazing what he created out of I guess this is orange groves, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, and he's very much tied to the history of Winter Park when Chapman and Chase founded the city. Charles Morris was really one of their first customers,
right.
And obviously he was from Chicago and owned the Morris Fairbanks company and wintered down here. And then when the freezes came and the land company failed, I guess it was just called the land company at that time. Morris actually bought it. Harold Ward, who was his grandfather, I think, was working for the foundation or working for the land company. And they actually hired, Morris hired Mr. Ward to continue on because he was familiar with the property and so that eventually transferred to the Hosmer Morris Foundation. And Mr. Ward still is, the Harold Ward III is still the president of the foundation. So there's a long standing relationship with the city.
Yeah.
And they were benefactors to the, you know, university club property was donated by the Morrises. The women's club was donated by the Morrises. Central Park was donated by the Morrises. All of the, many of the churches and civic facilities in this community were from the, you know, the benefactors of the Morris family.
Mm-hmm.
I believe those words shared by Mr. Morris when he walked in the land office went like this: so how much do you want for the whole shebang? And when he said that, I think he was equipped to do that. He was a survivor, an industrialist. He was a part of that Gilded Age industrial. And condition that he had was that Mr. Ward would come along with him and help him sell those lots, which is a great story of faithfulness. And what I know from my little background at the Morris Museum of American Art as a docent, he was a very humble man. He didn't want his name lent to a street or things. He was just a God-fearing good guy that wanted to be generous.
Yeah, and he was.
He was.
So, Gary, you mentioned a minute ago what happened in 1914. So tell us more about that.
Well, Charles Morse asked Harley Ward and Dow George to build this golf course. Build the first 9 holes and then put 18 holes around it. So there's like 27 holes in this area right here. But they were the primary developers of at least how the golf course looked like. And Dow George, I think, became the first pro of that golf course. And it stayed there for a long time. He stayed throughout, into the 20s and 30s that he was involved with the golf course. Those names seem to crop up almost everywhere in our search. Dow George and Harley Ward, pretty good individuals.
And Dow George had a lot of relationships in the golf industry and golfers. And he brought Sam Snead here several times during the winter to have exhibition matches.
So that's a great segue into something I was going to bring up later. So Sam Snead, other professional golfers, big names at the time, and even big names to this day in the pantheon of golf, have played here. And in all the stuff I went through, I didn't see any pictures of that, which surprises me. You'd think if, you know, if some big shot golfer today came and played our course, we would take some pictures. We're in the kind of Instagram era where, you know, it doesn't happen if you don't take some pictures of it. But is there any pictures of that? And if not, why not? Why didn't we take those?
I don't know. I had a friend that I worked with many years ago when he grew up here and he played golf here as a child. And he remembers Sam Snead coming out and doing an exhibition. And he said on the fourth hole, where it's the big dog leg, actually that hole was extended when we expanded the cemetery, but it was almost a 90-degree dog leg. And there was an oak tree right there at the corner. And he said Sam Snead was back at the back tee. He shot over the oak tree, and he landed at about 90 yards off of the off of the green.
And that's why he's Sam Snead.
But the golf, I'm sure the oak tree wasn't as tall as it was back then, and that's what...
Well, you talk about pictures. If you see the picture, you're right. You don't see Sam Snead or any of the players, but we have pictures of some animals that they had out here. In 1917, they had the sheep and goats that helped take care of the fairways, but they also were, I understand, were there to graze and then use the meat from that, because I guess there was a shortage of meat that they provided the meat. And that was in 1917. I've seen a picture of that.
So
it's like those are the pictures. I got to see pictures of goats and sheep.
This is not a great picture, that, but it's...
That
it's,
picture.
There are the... There is photographic evidence of sheep and goats on the fairways, which, like you said, that eliminates the need to mow a lot, I guess. So,
and this photograph shows the actual greens were sand at the.
So I was going to bring that up. So I've seen in the archives here some refer to it as sand and some refer to it as clay. Right. So, Tell us a little bit about that. What was that traditional at that time?
I think that was a pretty standard thing. They didn't have the variety of grasses today that we have today.
Yeah. I don't know the history of that. We joked before we remodeled it that we returned to sand greens. so that I think that's why this group got together to get it in the condition it is today. Yeah, those are some great pictures of that, and can imagine it had to be something firm, or you wouldn't be able to putt. The clay makes more sense than sand, but the pictures make it look white. So I don't know.
Therein is the reason. They didn't have the mowers that we have today, where you could cut it down to next to nothing. So they had sand and or clay that you can putt on, and at least have a chance of making a putt, as opposed to if you ever try to putt on something that's half inch or higher. That ball does not roll.
That's a good point. I mean, I'm sure the advancement in mower technology over the years had something to do with that.
The goats couldn't get it to
apparently not, yeah. They weren't that hungry, apparently. that was in 1918, I'm told, that the greens were replaced with grass. So I guess at that point we had the adequate technology and grasses and whatever to be able to do that. So I'm going to pass around a picture. You mentioned that at one time we had a full 18 holes and then another 9. And I want to talk a little bit about where those were. You referred to that earlier. And so this down here sort of looks like it's at what is now part of the Rollins campus, right?
Well, no, that was the original golf course, I believe, before this golf course came into being. The 27 holes went from where it begins now, but went all the way out to where the Winter Park Village is today.
Okay.
And so it kind of followed Webster Avenue all the way out to 1792. And that was retracted to 9 holes. And that's about the time when the Winter Park Mall was built in the early 60s. Apparently, there was not enough interest in supporting the golf club, but went out of business for a number of years during the 50s, I believe, late 30s, 40s, when the Aloma Country Club was built out at the corner of Lake Mon and Loma. World War II came along. Everybody went to war, including all the golfers, and the golf course it was a private country club, but it failed. Property was deeded to the city for parks, and then part of the property was deeded to the hospital for the, you know, for Winter Park Memorial Hospital, now the Florida Hospital, or I guess it's Advent Hospital now. And they came back to this location then to restore the golf course. But at that time, it was down to 9 holes.
So in 1931, I'm told that the Rollins College golf team entered intercollegiate competition for the first time, and that they, I guess, used this course from time to time to practice on and so forth. As you guys know, we have an exhibit at the museum right now, a shameless plug here, for the Rollins, the first 50 years. And wanted to just throw that out there. Did anybody have any stories or anything to say about sort of the history of Rollins and golf and Winter Park and how that might overlap?
They're still playing here. In fact, I was here last week, and the women's golf team was out here practicing. And they're the number one. I think they finished number one in the nation for their conference.
Yeah, they've won the national championship multiple times. Six. The women. Oh,
that's one. Okay. Our current coach, she's phenomenal. And yes. She brings the team out here all the time and helps us actually maintain the golf course. They willingly go and replace the divots that occasionally we'll see in a fairway, and or replace the ball divots. They're great. It's a great addition to us. I tried to get them as a partner when we were.
And they were one of our corporate sponsors when we reopened.
Corporate sponsor, yeah, that's what I wanted. Yeah. She was wanted to be part of it, and so we met with Steve, and we put together a program that involved them for 3 years. That's a great partnership to have them here. They don't misuse the golf course, and they add a nice flair to it to have those girls out there playing. So.
I think another thing, not necessarily golf, but as a part of the Morse legacy, was that Mr. Morse came to Winter Park, and he brought his granddaughter with him. I believe he was widowed at the time. And as a result of that, then Jeanette, who was his granddaughter, subsequently marries Hugh McCain, who becomes the president of Rollins College. So it's the family, the Morse family, has expanded, but made a major impact, even greater impact, in this wonderful little city.
Absolutely. And then Jeanette and Hugh went on, as you alluded to a little earlier, they were friends with Lewis Comfort Tiffany. And tell us a little bit about that. I know that's a little off topic, but it's all related to the same group of people.
So Hugh was a young boy. He loved the arts. And he was growing up in Pennsylvania. And his father made application for him, and he was accepted as an intern at the Laurelton Hall, which was Louis Comfort Tiffany's, probably in my mind, one of the greatest artists in American history, based in New York City. He had a summer home on Long Island, at Cold Springs Harbor, and Hugh McCain was able to go there as a young boy in 1929. And that translated when the fire took place in the 1950s of Laurelton Hall, and it was his work, Louis Comfort Tiffany's work, was out of favor. What it translated to is not many people were interested in going to see if there's anything salvageable. And in those days, it didn't have value. Today, it's unmatched for its qualities. And so our Morse Museum, they went up, Jeanette and Hugh went up, said we must get all we can and bring back to Winter Park, which they did, and stored it in some amazing, unique places that were not necessarily restoration at its finest, but they, the Morris Museum, has made it a lifelong legacy. And I will tell you, from being a docent there, I'm amazed at the people who come all over the world to do research at the Morris Museum, because they have the archives of Louis Comfort Tiffany and Tiffany Studios.
Yes, yes. A wonderful story. So, Gary, you've got a timeline in front of you. I love the fact that you know, a lot of you brought visual aids. It's like show and tell. So I'm gonna let you do your show and tell.
Well, with the help of Teresa from the communications department, she put together the design of this, because we wanted to put a timeline in a pro shop. Wait, there's a soffit up there. We ran the timeline from one end to the other end. And so what I did coming to this meeting, we reduced this into something I could carry. I can't carry that. But it you learn a lot about doing the research and trying to get the pieces for this thing. Because it takes it from its creation in 1914 up until not quite today, but it gives us enough of what was happening over the years, because it takes it through the tough times and the better times, and watching how it progressed. But anytime you look at this, or in the pro shop, I'm going to donate this to the museum. They can do something with this, because I just wanted to have something along with this meeting. I didn't know exactly what we were talking about, but this has all.
Yeah. So are there, you mentioned the tough times, and I think that's one of the things that is interesting to me about history in general and the way we see history. A lot of times we sort of focus just on the good times, right? And obviously there are good times and bad times. And our exhibit of Rollins, the first 50 years, shows that it was not a foregone conclusion that Rollins was going to go on to become the liberal arts bastion that it is today. It was, there were times where it was skin of the teeth kind of deal to just keep it going, you know? And so tell us about some of the tougher times in the history of the golf course.
Well, the 30s was a tough time. I think we sort of hinted at the 30s, because you had this golf course along with a Loma golf course, which is the other golf course near Rollins and over, I guess, now Ward Park. But they couldn't support it. And so they shut down Loma. I think that's when they shut down Loma.
Yeah, I was told it was during the war, when all the men went off to fight the war. All the golfers obviously went with them, and the golf course failed. But Mayor Hotard, his grandfather, was the one that started that Loma, that whole area over there, and the Loma Country Club. And the clubhouse was right there at where is it a Walgreens or a CVS right at the corner of Lake Mott. And
so the focus then came over here, because they had to shut those other ones down. They just didn't have enough money coming in. And plus, you know, it made sense for them to sort of concentrate it here, because I had the 18 holes along with the 9 holes that we have here. The 18 holes eventually disappeared somewhere around, we're trying to figure out exactly the time.
When the
50s? 50 or 60s, somewhere in there, the 18 holes disappeared too. You just couldn't support it and then concentrate here on the 9 holes. And I don't want to jump ahead to this era, because we had our tough times really keeping the golf industry. The golf industry all took a turn downward just about when we were renovating this golf course. it was tougher times. But then, as you would expect, things changed and dramatically changed. I mean, we took a good time to change the golf course and make it more efficient and make it more playable. But then the pandemic comes, and that raised everything up like unbelievable. It brought back golf. So I jumped ahead.
But. No, that's great. And I think we can feel free here to sort of jump around, and that's okay. So let's talk about that. So the huge renovation of the Winter Park 9 in what year? 2014, right? Is that
2014.
Right?
2014. That was the 100th anniversary.
Right. And so, yeah, so let's talk about the centennial celebration. And anybody here for that? I imagine all four of you, right?
Of the golf course or of the city?
Of the golf course in 2014.
Well, that goes back to how we acquired that was as the Morris were making plans for their museum. They had a small museum on Welburn Avenue, very, very small. Then they had a very small piece of their collection on display there. And their dream was always to build a new museum. And we had a lease on the property. We had two 40 back-to-back 40-year leases. So starting in, I think they started in 1908 was when Morris actually bought all the assets of the land company. And this was included in that and leased it to the golf club. So it again formed in 2014. But at the end of the lease in late 80s, Dr. McCain came to the city and said, you know, we're going to build our museum down here on holes 2 and 8. And then we're going to develop the rest of the property and of course the community was upset about that because they had kind of taken ownership of the golf course. And so we both had the same attorneys, the Winder Weedle, Ward Haynes, and Woodman. So we had to hire an attorney to represent us. And we were playing shuttle back and forth between our attorney and their attorney, who was Harold Ward, who was still involved in that. And we were not getting anywhere. And I would go to church with Harold Ward. So one Sunday I said, we're not getting anywhere. Do you mind if I sit down with Hugh McCain? And he said, no, I wish you would, because he's insistent that he does not want to sell the property and that this is where he wants to build his museum. That's always been their plan and so on. So I invited him to lunch at the Park Plaza Gardens, and he said, I can't, it's too noisy in there, I can't hear, come to Interlochen. He was a member of Interlochen Country Club. So we sat there for an hour and a half having lunch, looking out over the nice 18th green. And he was insistent the entire time. And he said, why would the city want to buy it? Most of the people there don't even live in the city. The people that play golf there don't live in the city. It's kind of run down. You haven't taken care of it. And I said, well, you know, Dr. McCain, we've been sitting here for almost 2 hours. Have you seen one child come off of that green? And I said, just do me a favor, come down on a Saturday morning and see all the families that are, you know, that come out here to play golf. And this is, you know, kids can't go to a country club like, Interlochen to play. And so this is more than a golf course for the older people. This is a golf course for the community. Plus, it's green space for the city. So he called me back that next week and said, tell you what, you get an appraisal and we'll get an appraisal and then we'll talk. So that's what started that whole process. But he was not receptive at the beginning. And he said, and that's another thing he told me. He said, you know, you've leased this for 80 years and I don't think you've ever paid us. And so I researched it, and we had a dollar a year lease for 80 years and we hadn't. So anyway, we got our appraisal. It was for $8 million, a little over $8 million. And he had an appraisal for $8.7 million. We offered $8 million. He accepted $8 million. And then we closed in 1996, I guess it was. But I, as a kind of a joke, I went to the Mint in Atlanta, where they print the money. And I bought two sheets of dollar bills and I had them framed and a letter saying, you know, paid in full, and presented it to him at a commission meeting. And he still has it, or they have that at the office, I believe, still. So,
just to add to that story, I mean, they were talking about putting the museum basically across Park Avenue down there. And so you'd have a bookend of Rollins on one side, museum on the other side, which, you know, would have been spectacular. But you can imagine not having this green space and what this green space does for Winter Park and Park Avenue. But, you know, it wasn't we had to go to referendum to acquire the course. And so it hadn't been for the mayor's relationship with Hugh McCain, I don't think we had ever gotten there. But then we had the whole campaign to buy it. And we actually had a person that lived in Winter Park that challenged the purchase legally. And so we had to go through a big legal battle. His name was Martin Kessler. And he actually ran against Rachel Murrah for city commission so he would have a platform to talk about, because it was on the same ballot, you know, the election. So he'd have a platform to talk about why we shouldn't buy it. And he really wasn't saying we shouldn't buy it, but, you know, part of the deal was they insisted on a reverter clause, basically, that if it was ever not used as a golf course or green space, that it would revert back to them. And so Mr. Kessler's argument was, well, then it's not worth $8 million. It's worth $1 million if you can't use it for anything but a golf course. And because the $8 million was based on it being developable property. And so it went all the way to the Florida Supreme Court, and Mr. Kessler represented himself the entire time, never had an attorney, and they gave him great leeway in all those hearings. But the city ultimately won, went to referendum, passed it 89% of the vote.
It was June 4th, 1996. The group that we formed was called Keep It Green for Tomorrow. It was just a campaign, basically. We had signs and mailers and so on and forth, like you would have for any other political campaign. And the vote was actually 3,497 yes and 1,076 no.
Which, you know, the voters are voting to tax themselves to acquire these seven holes that we didn't already own. So that's you look at any bond referendum, that's an overwhelming number of yeses.
And so that, you know, then the museum acquired the piece of property that they own now. That was an office building at one time and a retail store, and they combined the two buildings and created the museum. And so everybody was happy at the end. And the museum opened in 1995, I believe. But Dr. McCain had passed away by then. And we had a nice opening of the museum. And of course, the golf course was being repaired. When we first bought it, it was in terrible condition. I mean, because in the 5 years that we extended the lease, the city was not putting any money into the irrigation systems or the greens, and it was in bad shape. And what was the golf pros that was here before?
Steve Lundblatt.
Okay. He had a friend from Cleveland, because he had been a golf course person from the city of Cleveland, and Bill Carrico had both worked at. That's how Steve got here, because Bill Carrico knew him from Cleveland.
He was the parks director at the time.
And they had a friend that was at a private course down in Palm Beach in that area. Dave Trask was his name. And he was tired of dealing with the members of a private club, so they enticed him to come up here. And I remember walking out on the course, and there was... the only place if there was grass was in the rough, because there was no grass on the fairway. And he's kicking the sand, and, you know, and he says, oh, I can have this in shape in about 6 months. And I said, you're kidding. And he did. Within 6 to 8 months, this course looked, you know, entirely different.
Dave could grow grass on a moving car. I mean, he was talented.
And what year was that?
96, 90, you know, 97, I, you know, so I left office in 97, but I think he came about 90, right after we bought it, so 95, 96.
So in those years, go by. In 95, the Moore's opened at its present location, which is perfect.
Yes.
Ask the merchants on Park Avenue.
Yes, yes.
It's perfect for the city. It's the other end. It is our staple at the north end of Park Avenue, and then we still have our beautiful course.
And kind of accomplishes that bookend sort of thing that you've referred to earlier. So one thing that just sort of jumps out at me is, the $8 million, which seemed like an exorbitant amount at the time. I don't even want to speculate what this land would value at today, but clearly well north of that number. So I think that was a good acquisition for the city. I don't think there's any debate on that. So with the addition of him being able to kind of reconstruct the course, it was sort of on a path towards a better days, right? So, and then in 2014, the renovation happened. So let's talk about that and what led up to that and all of the good stuff about that.
That's when the task force was formed, because during that time, we didn't realize, none of us realized what was happening underneath the golf course, the irrigation systems and all those things, knowing that there was something that could be better. And so the task force was formed. We didn't know what we were being formed for to do, except polish the gem. This was always considered a gem. So we were told to polish the gem. And so there were about five or six of us that were on those task force. Bill was one of them. Matt Haggerty from the Golf Channel. Brian Fury. Those are the main ones that were on that right there that I could think of right offhand. Anyway, so we started having meetings. I didn't know what to do, so I started doing a lot of research and found out that really, running a golf course, if you're going to run a golf course right, you got to renovate it every 20 years. That's taking the tee boxes, the fairways, the greens, the bunkers. We didn't do that. We couldn't find any records that it had been done. And so the other serious thing was this irrigation system hadn't been touched in 30 years. That triggers all the downfall of all those functions, those greens and fairways and whatnot. So it was, the grass was being replaced by weeds and dollar weeds, and so it needed some help. And so that's why we started going through this thing, and I got some help from Lee Ruffard that we found that we knew that golf courses should be rehabbed every 20 years. And we got the documentation that's put out by the Club Managers Association, the superintendents and the architects, put together a document that said, you've got to do these things. Otherwise, you're going to have some problems with keeping the grass looking like you want it to look. So then we had to twist Randy's arm. Hey, we need to get some support here trying to figure out how we can raise some money to do the things we need to do. Because it turned out that we're going to need about $1.2 million is what we're going to need in order to do it right. Find some architects, number one, that was going to work for that amount of money and do the thing we need to do and polish our gem. And they did a phenomenal job. Right? That's all I can say is the architects did a great job of rehabbing this golf course. Renovated totally, everything. And the other thing is we also learned in doing this thing that we had to do a lot more communication with the people of Winter Park, what we were going to do and why we're doing it. The players also needed to know what we were doing because they think, you're going to renovate it, the golf course's price is going to be way up in the air. No, you're going to need to do this thing, and you'll see as we go, and you'll be part of this thing, what's going to happen and how you're going to benefit from having this thing rehabbed. And we're not going to inundate you with new prices that are out of sight. It took us, the renovation takes 3 months to take up everything out, take all the grass off. We took all the grass, we skinned the golf course. And we got the community involved helping us sprig it, a new term for most of us.
Yeah. I was very skeptical.
Skeptical that people would participate in this or...
We're throwing something that looks like dead grass around the golf course and it's supposed to take off and grow. We're like, there's no way this works.
we had little kids out here throwing it around and stomping on it.
And the first surprise was in talking with the architects and well into the design, and we get to the part, well, when do you plant the grass? Oh, no, we don't plant the grass. What do you mean you don't plant the grass? Oh, no, that's, we design it. We get the turf or the ground shaped like it's supposed to, and y'all plant the grass. What are you talking about?
It was a new experience for all of us, believe me. And I mean, it worked. I mean, we took a piece of land that was very flat. We took and elevated greens and put undulations in the greens, undulations in the fairway. And they listened to me I said, we need to really go to the Scottish type of bunkers that have these big lips all the way around it. Because I want people to see it, and when they're driving down Webster, be able to see that there's something different that's happening out there, and it gets their attention. What we didn't really realize is that we have to train all the players, because they don't know how to enter or exit the bunkers. They, like the old days, we didn't have much of a bunker and didn't have much elevation. They just walked right on in and walked right out. These, if you walked on the edge, you broke it off. So poor superintendent Ed Batchelor, who was constantly repairing those bunkers, and we had the pros as people checking in to train the people how you get enter a bunker and exit a bunker, because otherwise we'll be repairing those forever. And it all worked. It eventually worked, and we wound up having a golf course that is not only ranked locally as one of the best in the area, one of the best in the state, one of the best in the country.
Yes.
And then it goes internationally. We became 41st, ranked 41st in the world. So the whole thing worked out beautifully. And everyone was happy with spending the $1.2 million, I think, most of them. Not everybody was, but mostly they were. But they understood that it was a good investment in it, because it turned into something. Because one of the other things that I was driven by, I wanted to see this golf course be self-sustaining. And I thought that would make him happy if we could do that.
And the Winter Park taxpayers happy, right. Of course.
Absolutely. Because it was a drain on the city. It was not something that just, it wasn't in this condition, was not good for the city long-term. So that was one of our goals, is how to make this self-sustaining. We almost did it the first year. We unfortunately bought some pine straw at the very last minute and put it into last year's budget. It should have been in the future budget. But the year two, I think we came close to breaking even on year two. And then started making money from there on out, and it continues. And we got a good staff. We got a good staff in the pro shops. We had to do a lot of little things in every segment of the operation of running a golf course, besides rehabbing the golf course. That started, the other things came along with it.
Absolutely.
And now we have this, like you said, gym that is self-sustaining. It's internationally ranked as one of the best 9-hole courses in the world. I mean, that's phenomenal, really, and it's on the Florida Historic Golf Trail as well.
We were the first golf course to be in Florida to be involved with the National Historic Registry of Historic Places. The first.
I remember talking to the architects or the people that were out here. This was a very short course. It's, you know, yardage wise, it's, you know. And I remember talking to him. He said, well, we can't make it any longer, but we can make it more difficult. And they did. I play here weekly, and this first green here, it's almost impossible to land on that green and keep the ball up there. And it's just, and I had a reputation. In fact, you would talk about, well, where do you want to play Winter Park? Oh, that the old man's course? And that's the reputation that it had. And but we've obviously have changed that now.
It's still one of the beautiful things about this course is that it's a walking course.
Right.
And so it's short. You can walk it. There's not, you know, there's not a mile between holes, you know, so it just it makes it fantastic. And there's over the years, I've always been, why don't you have more golf carts that people can rent? And we don't want to change that. You know, it's
a walking course.
It's a walking course.
Well, and didn't ADA require that we have golf carts?
Right. So we do have some, and you can use them.
That's a good point, because one of the things, we challenged the architects, and they were both Keith Rebbitt and Riley Johns were phenomenal. Not only were they architects, but they also were actually running the bulldozers and moving dirt all over. You don't get that.
Yeah.
You don't get that when you take a Jack Nicklaus or Greg Norman, or that they're not going to do that. They'll be there the first day and maybe come back the last day. They'll come back and take it. But the thing that was important also, that the challenge that we gave to the two architects, this golf course has to be played by pros and kids and enjoy it. That's a challenge, because today, what was happening in the golf industry, where we're seeing a decline, is that we were building golf courses that are so darn difficult, and they're so long that the maintenance of them was impossible. But you have to be a real long drive hitter in order to play it. This, you don't have to be. Long drive guys can play. They use irons and woods to play out there. The game starts around the green. It isn't the length between here and there. We don't have that. We're landlocked. We can't We can't push it out any further. So we got 2,480 yards, I think, is what we have in distance. But it's perfect. It's great. We're at the right place with the right type of golf course. Nine holes is where the industry was being, didn't realize that that's where the industry was going, because you're losing people who didn't have 5.5 hours to go out and play. They needed 2 hours. Perfect. We got the two-hour round golf right here. And we don't have to even, it's amazing. You don't have the guys going around and pushing people to play faster and faster. The people do it automatically. That's what's neat about this thing. You don't have to have a ranger out there yelling at people to get going, or you're holding up things. So it's worked out beautifully for the city, because I think we've become the asset that they wanted and deserved.
Yeah.
So.
And you've got professionals. Nick Faldo plays here quite frequently, and there's other professional golfers that they're talking it up all the time.
I think there's another story, a backstory that needs to be shared, because I love Winter Park. We ran to this little town. And the story is this. So the centennial of the golf course is going to occur. And the Golf Channel wanted to use this as a venue to produce. And it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Golf Channel came out with a philosophy during the difficult days of golf: make it fast, make it fun, and make it affordable. And with those three linchpins, this became kind of the reason they wanted to broadcast here. Many of them, this is their home course, the executives. But anyway, Mayor Ken Bradley was a person that I knew, and I don't know how it got to this, but one of the things we wanted as a gift was to get the starter's clock. So we would have a starter's clock like the old course, a really classic starter's clock. And they drafted me to go solicit the Genius Morse Foundations for the starter's clock. And the reason they did is because I was a docent at the Morse. So I went over and met for the first time Gary's friend, Mr. Dick Strauss, who is the senior VP and trustee of the Morse Genius Foundations. And I asked him if they would consider being a gifter of something to the tune of $15,000 to $18,000 for a starter's clock. He said, well, I'll take it to the board. Certainly seems like a noteworthy cause, but let me ask you a question. What are you going to do for the next 100 years? Because the golf course really is struggling. I take it he was a golfer. Gary knows him better than me. But he was speaking about what's going to happen next. And so when they went to consider as a board whether they would fund the starter's clock, that was the seed, because I went back to the mayor and said, well, he said, what are you going to do for the next 100 years? And it was then that he came up with the idea, not me, came up with the idea of seeding a golf, what do we call it, task force that came together, two Golf Channel executives. Gary was a senior executive in the golf business, knew people around the business, and it was those people that made a major difference that brought it together. So
absolutely. And that starter's clock is a piece of the Winter Park history and the Winter Park history of golf as a result of all of what you just shared with us. I love that.
And it salutes Charles Osborne Morse, a great, great
as it should. President. Yeah.
Dr. McCain also was kind of insistent that not just be a golf course, that this be available for other things. And part of the design, when we purchased it, we were going to build a walking trail all the way around the course. It was never finished, but we started right out here. And you'll see I don't know if there's a monument or a sign out there, a little, maybe it's called Morris Park, and it goes down to the fountain that's over here. That was the first phase of it. But he wanted other people to be able to come out and use it, not just golfers.
Well, that was the other thing that we Dick allowed us to get to some land to enlarge the parking lot because we were running out of parking spots. And he helped us get that cleaned out, and so that you get a walking place all the way between here and the next hole. But one of the things in the rehabbing, what you find, well, number one is getting rid of the invasive weeds and vines that we had behind the fifth hole tee, anyway, so you can see what is seen in most of the English or British open tournaments where they have the train going by. Well, now we open that up, and people now like to see the train, yeah. And thanks to you guys getting them to stop blowing the horn, even made it really fit in beautifully with the whole operation of the golf course. But the other thing that we found in cleaning out some of the vines and something like that was that fountain that's over on next to the eighth green. A beautiful fountain. Didn't even know there was a fountain there, but now it becomes a major area for people taking pictures.
Sure.
So it's what we've also in doing this thing. We've in helping the community really get more involved with this whole thing, and the putting green. I know when we first approached putting the putting green out next to the ninth tee, people said, what in the world are you doing that? It used to be right here, but it's so small you couldn't really do anything. Out there we have 10,000 square feet, I think, is that, where the community can come out and sit there with their kids and watch what's going on. And these are the benefits that you get from really improving the value and or the appearance of our golf course, because this thing is a true gem now.
Nothing better than a Friday night watching a wedding take place at Casa Feliz, families putting, dogs running around, people walking, and golfers going off the ninth hole.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I love the fact that you guys have segued right into the next thing I was going to talk about. So let's tell us about Casa Feliz and how it ended up where it is.
So I think there's people here much more knowledgeable than me.
The Holler family owned that house. That's where they resided. It was across the street right here from the golf course. And a couple purchased the property, and they were going to tear the house down, which was a Gamble Rogers design home. And of course, the community was, you know, anytime you're going to tear anything down in Winter Park, you're going to run into a problem. So, but the community came together and raised the money to actually physically move that brick house off that property and down to the golf course corner here. And I mean, I was here just to watch. I was astounded that they could accomplish something like that. But and it's made a nice addition to the, you know, to our property. And the city arrangement, we own the land, but we don't own the.
Right, we own the land. We lease it to CASA for, I think, a dollar a year. I don't know if they paid us. I'm going to go check after after your story. But yeah, it was an interesting process. I mean, they thought they could move it across the street and get it there in like one day. We'd have to shut the course down for one day. It took a lot longer than that as it crawled.
As it
creeped across the street. But the night the commission approved moving it, they actually had a bulldozer out there and clipped the corner of the house. They were going to take it down that night, and the police department stopped them because they knew the commission had approved us moving it, and so they were going to take it down. They didn't want the hassle of the delay, and it did delay their project for probably a year before they could build on that property. So it was, you know, ultimately it was very gracious on their part to let us take our time and move it. I can tell you they didn't lose money, but this community can come together for causes, and that was a great example of it.
Absolutely. So we talked a little bit about next 100 years and looking forward, and one of the nice things about studying history is that we can sort of lay that against what we think might be coming in the future, and it can help sort of influence, you know, how we see the future and how the future ends up playing out. So we have another golf course in Winter Park, and the city has taken an interest in that, and I don't want to steal your thunder. So, Randy, tell us about what you're allowed to tell us at this point about the goings-ons with that.
Sure. You're talking about the Winter Pines Golf Course, which is, you know, over by Winter Park High School area, the southeast corner of our city. Some people don't even know that's in the city limits, but that is the most furthest property that's still in the city limits from where we're sitting. But there's an 18-hole course there, so it's also a shorter course. I think it's a par 68 or 67. Yeah. And so the owners approached us about 3 or 4 years ago. Mayor Leary and I met with a developer that wanted to develop the course, and we told him our comp plan wouldn't allow for that, and they kind of went away. But we've seen this happen all over the region with golf courses dropping to developers or cities or counties having to buy them to keep them from being developed. And so the potential of it happening was real. This past year, we were approached by the owner again, and they had an offer to develop just the southern portion that fronts Baldwin Park. And they wanted to let that be developed, and then they would make the other part of the course even shorter, maybe a par 3 course or something like that. And we again said the comp plan wouldn't allow it. And we kind of said, well, what would you be interested in selling to the city? And so that's what started the negotiations. And so we agreed on a purchase price of $7.4 million. Which ironically is cheaper than we paid for the 7 holes here. But it's not quite as prime a real estate. We're working through that due diligence process. According to the contract, we're supposed to close by April 23rd. The commission's approved an $8 million bond issue to do it. The plan would be that we would buy it, operate it as a golf course. Want to make sure people don't think we're doing something different. We actually, in the agreement, if we ever did try to develop it, the current owners would share in the profit of that, you know, so that they're worried about us just buying it, making them look like fools and selling it, you know, which we would never do, but I understand their concern. So that's where we are. We're in the due diligence process. The second reading of the bonds are on the agenda for this coming Wednesday as we sit here today. But I'm excited about it. I've looked at the financials. It's a profitable course, and so the the profit from the golf course should pay the debt service, so this won't be a burden on the taxpayers. Now, we're not going to be able to do what we did to this course right away unless, you know, somebody else convinces a mayor to set up a task force that that creates another project that's not in my five-year capital plan. But I'm excited about it. It's a great opportunity. It's a popular course. That's what this in store for the next 100 years.
Perhaps another gem to polish there. So, yeah.
You didn't have to. I'm sorry.
You're landlocked here. You can't do much more. You're doing a great job with great staff there up and running. But you still would like to add something, but you can't add it here. There is one place you could add it. And I've talked to him about that. He agreed originally, but they said, show that you could make this thing work first. We did. I haven't gone back. So I will old body.
And you don't have to have a bond referendum to approve this one.
Right. Yeah, so the charter was changed after we bought this golf course that said we could buy parkland with a bond issue without having to go to the voters. Because the concern was that, you know, certain properties might become available and we can't move fast enough to acquire them. You know, for example, if the Genius property around Windsong, that 40 acres ever, if they wanted to develop it and we wanted to just keep it green space, you want to be able to move fast. You know, the big piece of property there on Interlochen that they own, if that ever wanted to be developed, we want to be able to move quickly. So the voters approved a charter change that allowed us to buy parkland without a voter referendum. So this is the first project we're taking advantage of that new language.
One thing that made Winter Park attractive to me, there were many things, but I believe per capita we have the greatest parkland space of any community in the state of Florida. And I think it's a great decision, Randy, to add to it.
Yes. Yes. So let's sum up all of this, and I'll kind of throw it out for any additional fun stories. One story that I have heard of that perhaps you guys know better is there's, frustration sometimes that happens on the golf course. I'm sure you don't know anything about that. You're such excellent golfers, but occasionally people get frustrated on the golf course and there's a little bit of sort of golf rage, if you will. And I heard that one time someone was so angry that he set fire to a tree on this course. Has anyone heard this story?
I hadn't heard that story. I know a lot of people that wanted to cut trees down. If you want to see some rage come out at 1:30, I'm teeing off at 1:30.
Well, one of the things, when you play the old course in St. Andrews, Scotland, which Gary's very, very familiar with, when you're playing the last hole, you're going alongside cars parked along the road. And I will tell you that when you play this course, there are a couple of spots, but it makes it even more endearing.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful venue for golf.
It goes back, the layout of this course has changed over the years. Number 8 used to be a par 4, and you shot over Park Avenue, and the green was there where the putting green is right now. And number 9 was a par 3, and the tee was closer to the clubhouse. But they were hitting cars all the time, so they closed that and reconfigured it. When I first started playing here, because all of this was zoned and platted as residential property, residential lots. It was just because Mr. Morris wanted a place to play golf, as we had it for that purpose. But there were roads that went through the fort,
number four,
not a lot of traffic on it. It was still a dirt road in most cases.
We closed that one since I've been here.
So yeah, when we bought the property, then we were able to close that road, but it did go through into the cemetery. And then, of course, the cemetery was expanded, and that it made that hole a little bit longer.
Let's talk a little bit about this building that we're sitting in. This is a Winter Park Country Club, and there's a lot of history right here.
who wants to take that one?
It was built in the 20s, and you can see photographs of them probably in here. It's photographs of the building. It's probably in some of this as well. And there was the starter shack was over here, which was really a very small. Yeah, that's the same photograph, but that little it was a little tiny shack, and they've added to it. And several years ago, you redid the whole building, that whole building. But when was it the year that we actually remodeled this? Alan Trevelyan, who was a former mayor and a contractor, he took this on as a project because it was in pretty bad shape. When I first played here, there was a locker room back in here, club storage, and this was more of a storage space. It wasn't being used for anything.
And it has become quite the rental facility. It's very, very popular, you know, for smaller weddings, smaller events. And, you know, it does echo a bit if you're trying to do a seminar in here, but it's, you know, it's got that historic charm that you can't build,
right?
You know, you gotta preserve.
Yes. And you would not want to miss the bench on the side of the house on the Webster side that appears to be almost period because it's so erect, and it's where the people sat. I guess maybe Caddy sat there waiting for a bag.
Right.
And it's still there. It's beautiful.
Yes, yes. Well, gentlemen, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the generous time that you've spent with us. And this has absolutely been a treat for me personally. So I want to thank you all for being here and thank our audience for listening in and...